Thank you, Gwen. This is a hell of an unofficial meeting. I can't wait to see what that official one looks like. I know that I wish I'd gone to the bathroom one more time. Yeah. In fact, we might get out early. Unless I get a second bladder wind. I'm Bill Crawford, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am thrilled to be speaking first. You've got a heck of a lineup. Some of the folks I don't know, but I know that of them, and I've heard their tapes, and I'm fans of theirs. And I'm just glad I'm first, not following. I hate those Sunday morning deals when you're in such good company. I need to mention Dick. This is a pleasant, reassuring surprise when Dick and I, he says we sponsor each other up there in Charlotte, and that's not really true. I'm mostly the sponsee and him the sponsor, but we get together and we talk. We go to the same group up there in Charlotte, and then we meet and talk, and he listens to me and reassures me and reminds me of what this program's all about, as we do for each other. So I can't tell you how good it felt to see him. It was a surprise. So with all that being said, let me just get into that part that I'm up here for. I was telling Gwen said she was nervous. I said, well, you know, in a way, I've got the easiest part because I've got to tell my story, and I can't screw that up, really, if I tell the truth, if I do that. Now, I said, if I move to preach or something like that, I win a lot of trouble. But as long as I do like I've done 1,000 times before, however how many times it's been, and tell my story, we're all going to be in pretty good shape. If you're scared to talk, remember that nobody in the world else other than you can tell your story. And it may be that there's some people that try. I know that. But that you have that story that's unique to you, and it may be the story that someone needs to hear. So don't say no if you can possibly do it. I was born up in Greensboro where Dick and I met when I first came in the program. He was already there. I was born, I'm going to save you all the figuring and out and everything. I was born February the 1st, 1938. Makes me 39 years old. Hate to see people count. Yeah, I was 52 years old this past February, and I'm like the old saying, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken better care of myself. But I was born in a home with a dual problem that we had. It was an alcoholic home. It also had Southern baptism. And I think it's worth mentioning is you don't get over either one of those. I'm still both. Both are terminal, and I'm glad. I don't want to be over either one of them. But the alcoholism part was the part that was a strong influence, a very powerful thing in my life. Alcoholism is a very powerful thing. You know, if alcoholism exists anywhere, it has its effect wherever it touches, but certainly in a family, it sickens everybody. We know that. I'm preaching to the choir when I say that. Everybody in this room presumably knows that alcoholism is a very powerful thing. And unless someone gets well in that family, it's going to be sicker and worse and sicker and worse. And that's the way it was in our house. It was a good family. You know, my mother was a good woman. My father was a good man. People said of him, if he just didn't drink, he'd be a fine man, and that was true. And I knew that what was wrong in our house was my daddy's drinking. I didn't know anything about alcoholism, but I knew it was my daddy's drinking. And I knew that if he didn't drink, we'd be rich and famous, and we'd be just like, I didn't know about the Cleaver family then, but if I'd have known about the Cleavers, I figured we'd be like the Cleavers, and there were a family of Cleavers living up the street. I was comparing my insides with other people's outsides a long time, and I knew we'd be just like the Cleavers. They were names of the Wilsons, if he just didn't drink. But I grew up knowing that I would never drink. I knew that I would never put in me this stuff that Daddy put in him to make him like he was to. And he was a pretty good drunk, I need to say that. He was not a violent and mean and very unpredictable drunk like I later came to be. He's a pretty docile, gentle drunk. Right embarrassing at times. He'd lay down in the wrong places and this kind of thing. But it was not violence. I don't even remember my father using profanity. I'm sure he did at times, but he was not profane, and he was not a belligerent and hostile man like I became. But it was still a bad, insecure, very uncomfortable, scary situation. I knew I wasn't going to do it. I knew I wasn't going to drink because of what I saw in my home and because of my religious training. And we were trained, as you know. Most of you, I was trained, at least in my religion, it was sin and it was bad. And for those reasons, I'm never going to do it. And then along came peer pressure. Now I didn't know about peer pressure. I didn't know the term peer pressure then, but along it came. I got older, and I wasn't adjusting and fitting in with the people that were doing right. Now, I don't mean a lot at puberty or anything. I mean long before then. I was seeking Lord companionship at age 4. I would resolve to do right, and I knew what right was doing because I was comparing my inside with other people's outside, and I knew what the good kids were doing. They were sitting in Ms. Jackson's class with their hands in their lap, staring straight ahead, which she wanted us to do. I couldn't do it. I don't mean I refused to do it. I couldn't do it. I can't stay still now. I couldn't sit in Miss Jackson's class now with my hands in my lap, staring straight ahead for very long. And I certainly couldn't do it when I was 7 years old, so I got sent out in the hall all the time. And I tell people I'd have never learned to read if they hadn't written stuff out there, you know, graffiti in the hallway. And as life went on, I was not fitting in with the group that was doing well, so I got with the group that was smoking them cigarettes, you know. Boy, the effort I put into that. Learning how to inhale, you remember that? Doesn't impress these young people. These young people suck stuff in their lungs that me and you never even heard of, but you know. You remember what I was working with a camel. Back when you were about 13, and I'd practice somewhere so that when I was with them, I could take a big wad and it wouldn't fall down. You know, and I got to be a pretty good smoker, and I got to hanging with the cats. Now, long before punks, and long before hippies, and long before anything else, there were cats. Let me tell you what a cat was. Because I made it my business. Like I say, I was seeking Lord companionship from my very earliest memory. And I found the group of boys that I wanted to be like. I just took one look at them down in downtown Greensboro in front of Man's O'Henry Drugstore. And I knew I wanted to be in that group. They had the hair slicked back on the sides, squared off, right? Cut just square straight across. Yeah. Pompadour. For you new people, that's a flipper. And shirt collar straight up. Pants real low. And draped down. Big knees and draped down real small. Some of the older people. Yeah. The pants real low. Remember that? You just barely walk, keep those things up. Yeah. And I want to eat that rebel look. Because, I was a pretty good inhaler already at about 14. And I got my hair right. That took some work because I had still got real fine hair. And it done. And back then, I'd never heard of spray net. It was just you used stuff like wild root cream oil. And I'd have to put so much wild root cream oil on my hair, it was kind of white. It looked like my head was oozing out something. So a friend of mine who was sort of introducing me into cathood introduced me to a product called pomade, like wax in a can. For any blacks in the room, and I can't see you out there, you'd know that in that time the blacks used it. And the pomade, my hair problems were over. I had my drape pants, my shirt collar, my hairs in place. fact, pomade's still a miracle stuff if you're having trouble with your hair. You know that. I know the Final Net ad they had on a couple of years ago. They just tickle them to death that a lady could just go through all these antics all day long. At the end of the day, she'd be pooped. Her hair was still in play. Pomade hold your hair for 3 months. If a train hits you and they found your head, it'd be just like you combed it. Well, I say all that, which has nothing to do with anything except you know what I'm leading to. This was the crowd. It was the drinking, and the drug of accessibility at that time was alcohol. Now, we heard of some other things, and later on I came to get close to some other things, never really use it, but at that time alcohol was it. And I began to drink. And listen fast, because this is my social drinking period. It didn't last long. I drank the fear and the guilt that I associated with alcohol was powerful. I told you that with my upbringing. In fact, I had nothing but a negative image of it. So this tells you what kind of, I guess, what peer pressure is in the first place, but just where I was coming from. Much more powerful was the need to be included somewhere. And I drank a little bit along, a half a can of beer or a sip of whatever they were passing around, until I got in me, and I was about 15 and a half years old, as I recall. I ingested enough cheap wine one night with two other guys, sitting in the old downtown cemetery there in Greensboro, to feel for the first time intoxication. Now, I believe that the book we call the Big Book, the book that's officially named Alcoholics Anonymous, is the last word on our disease. A friend of mine in Burlington, North Carolina, says, and I think he's right, that nothing new of any significance has been discovered about our disease since that book was published in 1939, and millions of dollars, billions of dollars, and great minds have gone into it, and I believe that. And maybe that's fanatical and fundamental, but I believe it. And it describes our disease, and you come away with a pretty good definition of what we got. I suffer from a mental compulsion coupled with a physical allergy. I cannot resist something that I cannot consume. And if that's a good workable definition, and I think it is, I was half an alcoholic that night. The mental obsession was there. It was like there was something empty in me. There was like a space that wasn't filled until I drank that night. Now, I didn't know that. I didn't see the significance of it that night, of course. I assumed what it did for me, it did for everybody else that drank it. I know better than that now. I believe the statistics that just 1 in 10 of us get from this drug, this special thing that causes us to addict to it and use it compulsively. But I had it that night. I didn't have that lag time that some of you had where it sort of grew on you. It was there that night. It made the world a comfortable place, and I was uncomfortable in this world. It made me a part of. It made all the ugly go away about you and about me and everything. It made me unafraid. The fear went away. I know that now since I've met you. And so I was hooked on it right from that point. And I made sure that I went to places where it was going to be done, and I began to hang only with the people that were doing it. And the guilt and the fear was still there. That didn't go away because I felt it. In fact, it may have intensified a little bit. But I told myself what a lot of us who come from my kind of background tell ourselves. One day I'm not going to do this anymore. Right now I'm just going to have a good time, sow my wild oats, raise hell, as we used to say back in my day. But I was not doing that, and you know it. What I was doing was learning to live, to cope, to escape, to live life by the use of a drug, and in my case it was alcohol. And it worked for me every time. No matter what form I took it in, it delivered unto me once again that feeling. It put the world out where it belonged. It made me a part of. It made me comfortable. It made me unafraid. It never failed me. You might say that it was doing a lot for me and very little to me. And I believe what it does for us is what gets us in trouble with it. And what it does to us is what gets us here or to some form of help, hopefully. But it did a lot for me, and I couldn't see much that it was doing to me. A little puking, you know, and during the training day. But we'd all puking. You remember that. My crowd didn't trust the guy that wasn't puking. Yeah. You figured he'd lying about the amount he drank. You see, if he never puked. And that was the good old days when you'd lie in reverse. Remember that? Drink 6 beers and tell everybody the next day you had 11. And that changes, doesn't it? Later you drink 40 and tell everybody you had 2. But that was the good old days. When we'd brag about the amount we drank. And I would tell myself one day I'm not going to do this, but right now I'm having a good time. And it worked for me every time. I don't know. Some of the people that say I would have been a basket case if alcohol hadn't come along and I'd have shot myself and all that, I've got to agree with them for me. Short of Alcoholics Anonymous, this miracle that we're dealing with tonight, this thing that we're celebrating tonight, short of this, the best treatment still I know for alcoholism is alcohol. I don't know anything about it. Now, we've had everything from ECT to Librium and everything else trying to treat it. I don't know of anything better than alcohol. Now, it demands a hell of a price if it does to you what it did to me. But short of this, I don't know of anything else. And so I drank it, and it made the boogeyman go away, and it made me at least up to what I thought was par. And of course, I didn't quit drinking. Only the patterns changed. And when I'm talking to a new group, and I'm sorry for those who mentioned that heard me before, because I'm going to tell some of this drunk old again, you get this fresh meat, you know, you can tell some of these old drunk stories. I know I look educated, but I don't have much education. I know that's a surprise, and I know now the alcoholism was a big factor in that. I went to very little bit of college. Went in the Army. In my day, you had to go in the Army, and I'd gotten out of college. I was in a lot of trouble over drinking. I'd gotten an incident happened, and no warrants were signed, thank God, but I had to get out of town. I joined the Army. So that if you feel like you're getting sort of professional slant to this talk tonight, I'll tell you why. They made me a neuropsychiatric technician in the Army, so... Most of you don't know what that is. You know, if you walk into a nut ward in the Army and you got the nuts in the blue pajamas, the neuropsychiatric technicians are the other ones in the white suits with the keys, and that's what I was. And that's when they taught me just enough psychology to worry about it. I would hear this stuff and I'd say, I don't know if any of you can identify with that, but I said, my God, I've got that. You know, I did. You know, I'd see a film on paranoid schizophrenia. I said, good Lord, I can't let it be ashamed if they found out I had that, you know. So I'd walk around, you know, I'd look at the sane ones and try to copy what they were doing. As before I'd ever heard of panic attacks and anxiety attacks, and I was having them, didn't know what I was having. And I was afraid I was going to fly apart. It'd be a shame up there in the ward for me to fly apart, you know, and go just as crazy in front of them as I felt inside. Do you know that feeling? But let me tell you something. When I would leave that ward and go away from that nut area and get over to the club on the base and start drinking again, that feeling would go away. That fear and that anxiety and that feeling I'm going to fly apart would all go away. And since I haven't done this in Atlanta before, I'm going to do it right now. I'm going to give you a quick education on alcoholism in case you want to be a professional. You want to go into work. I'm going to save you going to get you a bachelor's degree or a master's degree. You know the difference between us and them. That's baffled people. And, you know, I guess they spent, as I said earlier, $1 billion studying us. You know, get rats drunk and give them convulsions. And nothing wrong with that. It's a disease. They ought to research it. But never spent one dime, to my knowledge, researching them non-alcoholics. I've never heard of anything being invested in that. And they don't understand us, and we don't understand them. Now, I got a classic terminal case of non-alcoholism in my house. She's with me tonight. And, you know, during our courting days and early marriage, she'd drink some. In fact, she'll occasionally have a glass of wine now. Half a glass, maybe. And a few times, maybe a half a dozen times that I can recall, she has consumed enough to feel it. I hate for the newcomers to hear this, but you know what she does? She quits. She gets the pilot lit and she quits. Now you know that demands research. It's high time somebody looked into that. Well, I have, since she's my one control group, I have asked her, why do you do that? Why do you do that? And she gives me the same answer every time, or she used to, I could ask her. Because when I start to feel it, I feel as if I'm losing control. I don't like that feeling. So I quit. When I would leave the nut house and go to the only time that day I would have some semblance of control. The same stuff that gives me the feeling of omnipotence and control makes her feel just the opposite. And not that I understand that, but that's explanation enough for me. I don't have to know why. I just know that somehow this stuff reacts differently with my system. And that's okay. Anyway, by then I'm married, Kay. You know how we'll do that. Alcoholics, you know, just won't go off in the cave somewhere and progress. We got to. That's why we have a family disease, because we all got to have a family, you know. Have young'uns and make them sick, too. And I started. And we came back to Greensboro with our new family, where things were going to be better. And of course, they weren't better, they were worse. And what alcohol was doing for me, I had to have, but it had long since started doing to me. It had long since demanded its price. I had them blackouts when they first came out. I know. You know, I found out since I've come here, and y'all told me that non-alcoholics don't get blackouts. You know, you can take one of these, you take someone like Kay and just wipe her out with it. And every minute that she's awake before she goes comatose, she'll remember in all probability. With me, very early, I would have these lapses in memory. And I didn't even understand that, didn't know that at first. You know how it happens, and it kind of creeps up on you, think you remember everything, and then you get a report. Get you mixed up with somebody else, that's what you think. I started losing control of the amount I was going to drink real quick. For me, my whole drinking history didn't take quite 14 years from the very first till I came in day eight. So I hit the ground running, and I had the loss of control. Now, I didn't know I had lost control. You couldn't have come up to me at that time, I don't believe, and convinced me that I'd lost control. I just mess up every once in a while. That's the way I looked at it, just kind of screw up. I intended to drink a little bit, and I drank a lot. But other people do that. I can remember when Kay would nag me about staying out so late. And you know how we hate to be henpecked. I don't know how the woman alcoholic, maybe that's rooster pecked, she thinks of. But I'd been down there with my buddies, telling them what a rotten situation I had anyway, and you know, you always get support from them. Why don't you kill her? You know that. Yeah. You're never alone in that in that situation. And I would just refuse to be henpecked. I'd say, everybody, I started my ham sundry then. That was my place in our early married days. And I'd say, yeah, everybody stay. These other guys aren't sissy and have to leave. Always. They were kind of, I thought they were, I didn't know the term yuppie then, but I saw sort of the, considered the yuppies of my day. And I later realized that this was four or five different crowds that would play through hams, you know, every night. I was there with all of them for closing. And then some nights I wouldn't get home at all. Lost control. I lost control of my behavior. I wanted to be a nice guy or funny or a lover or whatever I wanted to be, and I was becoming more often than not antisocial, unpredictable. And that's when guilt and shame and that terrible fear, that feeling of being the only person in the world started coming over me, you know, in early age, in my 20s. I'd wake up in the morning, you know, and have that terror, and I knew that I hadn't gone home at all, or I'd gotten home very late, and having to make it to work. And talk about willpower. I like to get him a little stab for willpower. You know, they say we ain't got willpower. And you know that's not true. We got more willpower. There are people in this room that have gotten up and gone to work and worked all day if a normal person felt half that bad, they'd be in intensive care. In fact, there's a lot of you. And I was starting to do that. And I discovered, as we say, the morning drink in my 20s. And so that could get me off places. And I started, and the job thing started happening. I didn't get fired from these early jobs. It just started happening that I would leave this place and go where I could exercise my artistic freedom, I reckon. I don't know. Sales jobs. Less clock punching situation. Until I was in a hell of a mess. And everybody that knew me that knew that I was in a mess. People even that I drank with knew that I was in a mess, and my drinking was not ordinary, at the very least. And the young couples that you start hanging with and playing bridge with, or in our day at least, that we found some sort of bond or friendship with, started falling off. And I started hanging with people that I wouldn't have associated with. And I started going to places that I hoped that I wouldn't be caught dead in now. In fact, I've been kicked out of a few places that I hope none of us would be caught dead in. Bamboo Lounge. You ever notice how those things have got names you don't even have to explain them? I can just tell you, I was kicked out for life from the Bamboo Lounge. I don't have to tell you it was not a private club. Or, you know. And this is where it was. And I got to a place where I couldn't hold a job. By then, I got two children, and shame is getting greater. And the morning drink had become bender drinking. And I would drink around the clock, day after day, coming to and drinking. And once again, I'm not talking about a man in his 50s, 40s, 30s, but in my 20s. As bad, if not worse, than daddy. And I didn't know what to do. I would resolve to quit. We were talking earlier today, tonight at dinner, when Kay was saying somebody asked her how many times she had to listen to this. And did she keep me honest? She said, I've only corrected him once. And that's when he used to go around, we'd make these local talks, and she'd ride with him, and I'd say I'd stay sober a month here and two or three months there. And she finally, after about 40 times hearing this, she said, you ain't ever stayed sober in months. You stayed sober one time for 4 weeks, and that was the time you needed to stay sober for about four generations. And that's where I was. in bad shape. And I couldn't get sober, and I couldn't get back to work, and that's when I started losing jobs. I never been to any treatment centers. They didn't have many. They had the state hospital, and for whatever reason, I didn't end up there. I did learn to detoxify myself, though. I kind of learned it from my daddy. We didn't call it detoxifying. I never heard that term. I called it tapering off. You know, you get drunk, and you stay drunk for about 3 days. If you just quit abruptly, you know, you'll fly apart. Your ears will come off or something. So I would taper off. Rather than just quit abruptly, I would dose myself out. Unfortunately, Cade would confuse tapering off with drinking. I don't know if that happened in your head. It looks alike to the untrained eye, you know. And I don't know if you had to exercise the patience I did, you know. I don't want to hear any more about it. I quit drinking yesterday. Today I'm tapering off. Of course, I had a little dosage problem a time or two. And I guess more than a couple of times, I'd get drunk tapering off, you know. And of course, nothing to do but start over. Well, I'm going to get out of this drunk law, quit drinking, and get sober. I was working for a crooked company because crooked companies were all that were left to me. And I'd been up to St. Louis, and I'd been drunk for the 2 weeks that I was supposed to be up there. And I flew back to St. Louis, and Kay came to pick me up, and I was drinking. Of course. And she brought me home, and I got down to my drinking uniform, underwear. I used to... Lisa's a little cleaner than usual because I'd been out of town. Usually it's just unchanged underwear. So a one-word description for me on about the sixth day was charming. If I pictured myself on these drunks, I'd have that dirty underwear because I didn't drink, I didn't bathe because that would mess up a buzz, you know. And I didn't eat. That'd mess up a buzz. And of course, I had an unaffectionate wife, too, which... gave me a tick, sort of. So I was in that thing, and I can remember Kay's Aunt Pearl. She's very talented with her hands, she ceramics and so. She'd make all the men this comic underwear. You know, it'd be with lace around it, and sometimes some vulgar stuff on it, but just all kinds of flowery, you know, get curtain material. I wasn't investing a lot of money in underwear at the time. The only underwear I had was just a series of Aunt Pearl's underwear. You know? And if I had the picture, I'd have that little vomit down my T-shirt and that crotch in Aunt Pearl's underwear down to about my knees. And this is, and Mr. Charming called AA in this condition in the middle of summer 1966. And I'm sure I did it. 90% of my reason was the same as the reason of every other drunk that I've ever called on since I've been in AA. And I've had the privilege to call on a bunch and try to carry this message to a pretty good bunch because I had that kind of sponsorship. But I'm sure 90% of the reason was just that. It was just to make a grandstand move to shut her up, to do something to get the heat off. But I believe 2 or 3% was a real cry for help, real desperation. And I believe that of every drunk I call him. I know he's conning me. I know he's not properly motivated. I ain't called on one yet. Met me at the door and said, "You got some steps I can start working." That's never happened to me. So if you're looking for that, don't go. But I believe it's that real cry for help in Alcoholics Anonymous called me back. And he's about as narrow-minded about tapering off as Kay, this fellow from AA. He said, "You're drinking." I said, "I'm not. I'm tapering off." Well, he didn't want to come see me that day. He said, "I'll come see you tomorrow when you're not drinking." And I am so glad that with me, he took that particular tack. I didn't get to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't call him back as I promised. Kay got home. And I was armed with the name and the number before she could say anything. I had a beer probably in one hand and his name and number in the other hand. I said, "I've called for help. I've called the A&A. There's his name and number." He and I agree that I'm not ready yet, but when I am, we're going to call him back. Now, that look of hope, I'm sure, overcame her, because you know how many times we can tell them the story because we believe it every time. If you're like me, I believed it every time. Each time I made the pledge, it was the truth. Each time the alcoholic has made the pledge to me, I know that coming from him or her, it is the truth. I couldn't drink. That day, standing in my underwear, calling Bill in at Alcoholics Anonymous, or when he called me back, I knew I couldn't drink. There had been 100 times before then that I knew that I couldn't drink. Everybody around me who knew me, most people that knew about me, knew that I couldn't drink. Now, I knew that when people said, "Crawford, you can't drink," that didn't mean I couldn't bend my arm and swallow. They meant what I knew they meant. I could not drink and predict the outcome. That when I drank, most of the time I drank until I was in trouble and sick and had done damage. That's what they meant. And many times I had known that. But what I couldn't know, and what drunks go to graveyards by the thousands, the tens of thousands, and never know, was that I could not drink. And we have to learn that, don't we? We have to learn what it means to be powerless over alcohol. I have to know that I'm hopeless before that there's hope. And somehow that day, it was just that time I knew that I couldn't drink. But when she came home, I knew I was back. You know, another beer was down me, and I knew that as soon as I got off of this one, I wasn't going to drink again. And of course, I did drink again. And again. But sometime 3, 4, 5 months after I made this call, when she was pretty confident that I wasn't going to call the man back as I had promised, she called. Now, she'd done a lot of stuff, you know, that like spouses of alcoholics do. She checked into stuff, you know how they'll do, and got some literature. She sprinkled around the house, but she had... This time she was calling and got somebody on the phone, a rank stranger, a voice she didn't know, a person she didn't know, and began to tell that person what was going on in our home. And for the first time, she was telling someone who not only understood, but who offered a solution. And he listened with empathy. And he said, "Yeah, may not be ready. He may not be able to do something about his problem now, but we have something for you." And he went and got Lib, and Lib told Kay about Al-Anon. And Kay started going to Al-Anon. And as some of you may have heard me say before, if you drink and your spouse gets into Al-Anon, it probably will not cure your drinking. That's not what it's designed for. But it'll break your rhythm, I'll guarantee you that. Now, all that happened at our house was a big, powerful, wonderful thing. Kay didn't get well the next day, and if she was standing up here, she would probably confess to not being well yet. But she started being less and less under the influence of my disease. She started being less sickened by my disease, less under its power. Or, to put it another way, she started becoming free of alcoholism. Just a little bit. Enough to change the game, right much. And I credit Al-Anon a lot with my getting to the doorway of Alcoholics Anonymous. On June the 2nd of 1967, I'm making that underwear again, sitting in that chair. And we were looking at each other, and I can't remember what we were saying, but I was dying. And she said, "Can we call Bill?" And she went and dialed the phone for me. Now, Al-Anon had taught her not to do things like that for me, but as a little technical for me on the first day of coming off a drunk, or just the first couple of hours. That's when the phones had the holes in it, you know. She knew I couldn't get my finger in there seven times and run her around, you know. So she got him on the phone. And I can remember what he said right now, very clearly. He said, "Are you about ready to throw in the towel now?" And I said, "I sure am." Because I sure was. Now, I'm not saying I was any more ready to throw in the towel than I was on the 20 previous drunks or the 50 previous drunks. I don't know, but I was ready. And somehow I think it may have been different. I don't know. But anyway, it was a late hour, and he said, "I'll come see you in the morning." And he came the next morning, Saturday morning, June the 3rd, 1967, and he sat in that little house that I was about to lose because I couldn't make $100 a month payments on. And he did what we ought to do. He sat there and shared with me about him and listened to me, whatever lies I was telling him. But the main thing he did is what I hope we all still do. He made that contract with him. Now, sometimes we want to rush out and find out they got Blue Cross so we can take them down to the treatment center first thing, and that's fine if that's what you want to do. But I hope that at least it occurs to us to get that drunk to an AA meeting. And he made me agree, or he asked me to agree, to not drink for the rest of that day and to go with him to Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And I agreed to do that. I may have done it because I wanted to get rid of him. You know, your attention span's short when you... Now, if you're like me, you know, when I was come off as drunk, you know, about 5 minutes of conversation about all I could hold. And I was about ready for him to leave. I was delighted that he was there. And I guess it did give me hope, even then. But I agreed to go. I was too sick to go that night. I just quit drinking the day before, and I was in terrible shape. In fact, I might not even mention to Kay that we had made that little agreement. Why bother her with a detail like that? But she had heard it. But nothing for us to do but ride over there. And we took the old Mercury and went over to the Starmount group. And I can remember walking in there, speaker meeting. And I remember old Homer Kay was the chairman. I remember how he looked when he was greeting people, and they had it at that time, what later became my home group and moved into much larger quarters, they had it there, Dick, you remember, in the plush ladies' study. And I walked into this beautiful room feeling just as conspicuous and the sore thumb that you do if you need it. Everybody's looking at me. That's what Gwen and I were talking about. We were talking about being nervous. I said, AA is the greatest thing in the world to this kind, because all drunks are paying so much attention to themselves. You know, you walk in with two heads and nobody will notice, you know. I said, it's the safest place in the world to screw up. Because everybody would be wondering, well, how did I look when Crawford screwed up? You know, anybody notice me, you know. But I walked in there feeling that conspicuous thing. And I'm going to talk about the miracles that occurred in my life that night. Because I never stand behind a podium like this if I don't talk about them. Because I believe, I am more convinced every day that these are real, bona fide, genuine God miracles. To much applause of this 18 to 20 people that were sitting there, some old boy climbed up after they'd done all this reading and stuff that I didn't understand. And this fella got up and talked for 50 minutes, and to some applause, he sat down. And miracle number one was, and I was in bad shape. Now, I'm going to tell you, I was coming off when I was drunk again. I was shaky, and the insides were churning, and the mind was foggy, and I didn't need to be tested on anything I was hearing. But somehow I understood this guy's message. I don't mean every word. I don't mean I assimilated every thought, every concept, but I understood his message as clear as the bell. He was telling me and those 18 or 20 other people that he had drunk alcohol hopelessly. That he'd come here to this thing we were doing that night and he hadn't been drinking and life was good, and I knew that's what he was saying. And miracle number two, and the thing I guess that saved my life, was I believed. And I hadn't believed anybody or anything in so long I couldn't tell you. I didn't even believe in God. And here's an old boy that had no reason to have any credibility with me, and I believed every syllable he spoke. Thank God. Because I was hooked on this thing, this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, long before I knew what it was, just like with the booze. And at the end of the meeting, we all went over to the other fellowship hall area where they had that alcoholic cake and that alcoholic coffee. That's how, you know, what I got, if you knew and you wonder why I got so much cake and coffee, that's how they can spot the newcomers. All the old timers stand there holding them steady cups, you know. And they'll be offering you want some coffee, and they know if you say no thank you, coffee makes me nervous, that you want the new ones. And that's what it. And coffee did make me nervous. And I didn't like sweets. I had outgrown my taste for sweets somehow. In fact, I mentioned to a couple, I used to like sweets as a youth, but I hadn't cared for them lately. And of course, they all knew my blood sugar was jacked up so high I couldn't stand to be in a room with a pie. But I thought my enzymes had changed or something. And they were all, you know, little hunks of pound cake, you know. Crumbs would fly when they talk. And these are the people I wanted to be like, because that was a big deal to me. It just was. But you know, the miracle, the machine, the body, the wonderful God-given body. A week or 10 days later, I'm spitting cake crumbs on somebody nearer than me. Tell them to keep coming back. And I was hooked on Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I'm for me, it's easy for me to say I didn't have any other place to go. When I met Dick and his like, I didn't have any other place to go. I didn't have to explain down at the country club what I was going to be doing on certain nights. None of that. There was no life for me. But that's not the reason. Because I know a lot of people that don't have any other place to go, and they don't come here, or they don't stay here. They die. So it has to be the miracle of what we call the grace of God. And I begin to learn about what our disease was, because this is where you learn. And I begin to identify with what they were saying. And I begin to associate with, because they surrounded me, what we call the winners. Those guys and gals that are committed to sobriety. Committed to this program. That's what it takes. And things begin to happen. Recovery begin to happen in my life. My original sponsor is Dick and Kay, can remember well, and I'm not in touch with him like I used to be, and I hate that, but I've moved away. Old Rupert, I called him Granddad, he was a fundamentalist. He believed, we went around to a lot of surrounding towns and made talks, or at least they did, and I hauled with him. And we did a lot of 12-step calls, went to a lot of conferences, and went to a lot of retreats. And we'd all sit on the front porch of Blue Ridge or one of these retreats or Camp Caroline and agonize over the steps and put off doing that inventory and all the things that I hope we're all still doing. And the program was working. I didn't have a job when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have anything. And I sure didn't have a job. I've been fired from one place 5 times. They just fire me for failure to return to work. I was selling cars, and they just send me a note, "You're fired again for failure to return to work." I remember going up to the club. I'd go up to the club. Kay was working. You know how those spouses will work, and she'd drop me off the club, and I'd sit there all day where I wasn't terrified of that telephone. Remember the telephone? How I scared that phone. say it was a fear of the unknown. I argued with him about that. I knew who was on the most of the time. It'd be somebody wants something back, like my house. And I was tired of it. I'd get, you know, there's that time if you drank like I did, there'd be that time you just fall into oblivion where you could lick the world. I'd have about 5 seconds of that before I was trying to get enough down to go back to sleep. And I grabbed the phone one time, and I thought it was Cameron Brown Mortgage Company, and I was going to give them some of my legal skills, and it's Sears Home Shopping Service. Kay had been sending them $10 a month, keeping my credit up, and it just nice as that. Nobody's been this nice to me in a few years. And I bought one of them refrigerators from that lady. Went on back to sleep and forgot about it, but they delivered the... They delivered a refrigerator, and Kay couldn't laugh about that for a couple of years. She was the only one in the house working at the time. But it was a good refrigerator. It lasted about 15 years. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the most difficult, yeah, there are many difficult things that have to happen, or many impossible, miraculous things that have to happen to get us through this eye of the needle to recovery, but to happen. And one of the most unbelievable things is to focus on this program, to do this program, and all other things will take care of itself. And you want to look at that old boy and say, bull crap, not right. No, you ain't got my problems. You think I can sit around here and smell that guy's cigarette next to me and drink this coffee and work these steps and these things are going to work out? But it does. And that's what they told me. If you just do this program, all this other stuff that's coming down on you is impossible. It can't work. There's nothing you can do there. Unsolvable, unresolvable issues. So I had to take that on blind faith and begin to do it and do these steps. And go out and help drunks when they didn't want help, and go to places that they didn't want, and go to a lot of meetings. And things started happening. I got that one job back, and we, you know, times have been tough in Alcoholics Anonymous. Times have been tough in sobriety. Bad things have happened. Bad things have happened. Bad financial problems have happened. Bad domestic problems have happened between Kay and I. We raised teenagers. I don't even need to add anything there, do I? By the way, if you're going to raise teenagers, you need some kind of program. I'll add that. If it's not AA or something, shoot yourself. You're going to have something. If you're going through a tough time right now and times seem really bad, whether you're new or you've been here for 40 years, it's going to be better. It always is. Every time that I have grown in this program, every change that I have made for the better that made me better, made me weller, came from pain. I'll only let go of something when it hurts so bad to hold on to it. I'll only change when it hurts so bad to remain the same. And so by focusing on the program, the good things have happened. I was fired in Alcoholics and all. You know, I was doing great. Lord, I was going to meetings, chairing meetings, out making talks, and quoting the big book. Sort of a poster child for AA. Been sober for 2 years and 3 quarters. My boss called in and fired me. Now, he didn't ask me if I was head of my home group. He fired me because I wasn't doing anything for him. He's that kind of guy. And I remember I had to turn in my car, and I had to call Kay to come get me. I always had to call Kay to come get me. Stood out there on the corner of that lot, 11 o'clock in the morning, waiting for Kay. And it occurred to me, people passing by would think I'm fired. We were talking about ego earlier today. So, I got two youngins and a mortgage, And my biggest worry is somebody ride by and punch your wife and say, "That's Crawford, I bet he's fired." So I did what you'd do. I looked employed and I checked my watch. Busy. Got in the car with Kay. Cried on her shoulder. Now I only say that to say this, that situation that seemed so tragic and so bad, I should have quit that job a long time ago. I should have been fired a long time ago. I hated it. It wasn't doing anything. It was nothing about it that suited me. And so what seemed so bad and so terrible in the present opened up for me. And I don't mean the next day or the next week, but in time, employment, opportunity, and changes beyond my wildest imaginings. What I do for a living now, I wouldn't trade with anybody, and it's beyond anything I would ever dream. And it's like Sam said at dinner tonight, it's nothing that I would design for myself. And that's just the way it happens. And that's not only the way it happens to me, that's the way it happens to everybody I've ever been close to in this program. I turned me over to God. And when I become willing to do that, I take the steps that make that happen. And all incidentals like marriages and relationships and society and jobs, etc., etc., handle themselves. Everything that's good in my life, everything of value, everything worth your knowing about me is a direct result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no other tricks up my sleeve, and I've never met anybody that had anything else. Or had any shortcuts. I know if you knew you expected somebody to call you over and say, "It'll let you in on the secret," you know. Now we've told you to go to meetings and work steps, but listen, us old timers in a full moon, we bury a dead cat in the backyard. But that doesn't happen. What it appears like these people are doing is what they're doing. And when I'd interview you old-timers wanting to have what you had, and I couldn't get it by osmosis, I couldn't pick your brains, I found out if I did what you did, I could have what you had. And that's a miracle. I got a good wife, and I got two good grown children, and one grandchild, and one on the way. And I could be drunk, and I could be dead. And probably by all rights and logic, I should be. Thank you. Thank you.